Okay, well, tonight we'll say turn with me if you will, but it's not back to the place where we have been, the regular Torah portion sequence in Leviticus, but instead it'll be back one more before that to Shemot, Exodus, and it's chapter 13. Actually, it's partway through chapter 13. We did a little bit of this last week, so turn now to chapter 13. We'll start at verse 17, which is the place where the children of Israel are fixing to go, well, out of Egypt and, more importantly, into or through the Sea of Reeds. And that's the reason why, and in the final Sabbath of the time of unleavened bread, this is the thing that's focused on. So essentially we have the Passover, and that's discussed, of course, at the Seder and the meal. And then this week of unleavened bread kind of ends appropriately with the study of the time where the people go through the Sea of Reeds. And it goes something like this. It came to pass when Pharaoh finally did send, he shellacked the people out, that Elohim led them, not by the short path, by the way of the land of the Philistines up the coast, although that was the close route, because Yahuwah said, lest, you know, perchance, the folks that are on this trip would, the English here says, repent. And it's, let's see if I can, yincham. And really, it doesn't so much mean repent as it does groan or regret or whine when they see war and decide that they'd rather just return back into bondage in Egypt. So instead, he led them round about by the way of the wilderness of the Sea of Reeds, and the B'nai Israel went up armed. I guess they hadn't been properly exposed to what's going on in America today if the tyrants get their way here. You got to figure Pharaoh, I guess in some respects he was more enlightened than a lot of the leadership now. Okay, well, that's an aside. In any case, Moshe also took the bones of Yosef with him because he had sworn to the children of Israel, saying, surely Elohim will remember you, and you shall carry up my bones away hence with you. So before he died, Joseph had made this request. It is, in fact, now being honored, and as they were asked or told to do, they did. So they took their journey from the place called Sukkot, and they encamped in Etam at the edge of the wilderness, the Midbar. And it tells us Yahuwah went before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light, so that they could go day and night if they needed to. And furthermore, it tells us at the end of this, and this is key, he did not go back on his word. And I think that's one of the things as we look back and ponder the significance of this week, the things we're supposed to memorialize that ought to stand out. This pillar of cloud by day and by fire by night did not depart from before the people. In other words, as he had promised he would do, in fact, he did. In spite of the fact that we're going to see over the next 40 years, there were a lot of times where they were not particularly faithful, to put it mildly. Then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said the following, speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn back and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, before Baal Zephon, over against it. That's where I want you to camp. And Pharaoh is going to say some things that will end up getting him in trouble. He'll say, of the children of Israel, they're entangled in the land. Surely the wilderness has shut them in. In other words, there's a trap being set here. And says Yahuwah, I will in fact harden. Now, in this case, the word there is that same root as chazak, be strong and of good courage, right? He will in fact make strong, strengthen Pharaoh's heart. And he shall follow after them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, and indeed the people of Mitzrayim shall know, Ki Ani Yahuwah. And they did so. Now, at this point I pause. I heard an interesting teaching this week from Rabbi David Foreman. And he makes a point that is something out of the Midrash, but I hadn't thought about it quite the same way in this context before. There are a lot of parallels, a whole lot of parallels in terms of the language and the context between what's happening here when the people go out of Egypt and when, in fact, Yaakov died and a whole lot of people also came out of Egypt. And essentially the big difference is, in this case, it's an act of divisiveness, if you will. And in the case that we're talking about with Yaakov, it was people who came out of Egypt, literally, to be echad. And they wanted to show their respect for this man, Yaakov. In other words, a whole lot of people doing something very similar. And there are references to the fact that, you know, originally they didn't take their children and their animals. At least they weren't planning on that, but Pharaoh wouldn't let them go. Well, in the case with Yaakov, they didn't take their animals and their children. They were coming back. So it's kind of fascinating to think about all these parallels, but the key difference is why the people of, why both sets of people, the children of Israel, and in fact, those who were chasing after them in this latter case, went and did what they did. And the key also, and this is the point here, in this thing where it talks about, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, I'll get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon his host, and the Egyptians shall know. It's not that there is anything in here explicitly at this point about killing them. The whole idea is for them to know who he is. And it would seem that in the first case they did, and they went voluntarily. And that's the difference here that cost them their lives. Say, it was told to the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned towards the people, and they said, what have we done? How come we let Israel go? So Pharaoh himself made ready his chariots, took all of his folks with him, 600 prime chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt and the captains over them. And it says Yahuwah made strong and literally willful, again, that root word kazak, the heart, the lev of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after him. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand, and the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them there by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, in front of Baal-Zephon. And essentially what happens next is it looks like they're trapped, literally between the devil and the deep blue sea, if you will. But it turns out appearances can be deceiving. So Pharaoh drew nigh. The children of Israel lifted up their eyes. Behold, here are all these Egyptians, the most powerful army in the known world, bearing down upon them. They were afraid. They cried out to Yahuwah, and they said to Moshe, another one of the standard whines that we've heard before. We'll hear it again. Why'd you bring us out here? Because there's no graves in Egypt? We had to come out here to die? Isn't that what we said when we were back there? Let us alone so we could just go ahead and serve here in good old bondage? Because it was better for us to, die on our knees than live as free men on our feet? Better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die here in the wilderness? Well, Moshe wasn't hearing anything of it. He said, quote, fear not. There's one of it's considered to be the most repeated command in Scripture. Fear not! Stand still and see Yeshuat Yahuwah. See, and actually it's et. See what? This is the pointer to the thing you're going to see. Et Yeshuat Yahuwah, which he will work for you today. You've seen these Egyptians before? Take a good look. Ain't never going to see them again. Because Yahuwah will fight for you. You will hold your peace. And there's an interesting line here next that kind of sets up one or two of the things that I want to make sure we talk about in this context, reading this. We just talked about it not too long ago, but now we're reading it again during this special time, during the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this verse 15 is kind of fascinating in that context. Why are you crying out to me, says Yahuwah, to Moshe? Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them to go forward. Move it on out. Get a move on. Literally, go ahead is the context here. Now, wait a minute. Look and see where we are in the story. Lift up your rod, hold it out. I'm going to harden the hearts of the Egyptians. They'll know. We haven't had this east wind blowing all night yet or anything. And yet, the commandment is already given. Tell them to go forward. And I find that kind of fascinating. What we're talking about here, in other words, is faith. And when I look back at this week and think about all the things that we are to memorialize and think about and pray about and consider during this time, that's got to be one of the standout items. And it certainly is every bit as appropriate now, given uncertainties and the fact that we don't seem to have a Moshe leading us on. We may have the devil in the deep blue sea out there somewhere. And Still, I think the same words apply. Why are you whining? Go forward. So kind of put that mark on the chalkboard, if you will. Think about it. We'll come back to that, no doubt. Because here's the place at where which Moshe is told, lift up your rod, stretch it out over your hand, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And in fact, the children of Israel shall go into the midst of the sea on dry ground. Behold, he says it again, I will harden, I will make strong, I will kazakify the hearts of the Egyptians, and they'll go in after them. And I'll get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the key, even the Egyptians shall know, ki ani Yahuwah, when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And the Malach, the angel, the messenger of Elohim, who went before the camp of Israel, removed. And instead of being ahead of them, he goes behind them and stood behind them between the camp of Egypt, where all of Pharaoh's troops were, and the B'nai Israel. And there was cloud and darkness here, yet it gave light by night there. So basically, he darkened their camp, gave light to the children of Israel, and that one and the other didn't come near each other throughout that period, throughout the whole night. And Moshe did as commanded. He stretched out his hand over the sea. Yahuwah caused the sea to go back by means of a strong east wind all the night. And he made the sea into, in fact, a dry area, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst, they went forward, as commanded, into the midst of the sea upon dry ground. And there were waters, literally, as a wall on their left hand. Actually, it says first on their right hand and on their left. Now, I've mentioned this before. This is one of the few elements, if you will, of the oral tradition that I really find kind of resonates with me. I don't, as you probably are aware, I don't teach oral tradition or anything that's not specifically written as doctrine. Now, sometimes it's interesting to think about. There are lots of things that are speculative. I have no problem with speculation and with kicking things around and the concept of Midrash. But on this one case, I think it's really interesting, and I'll just put it that way, to ponder what it is that is said about this in the context of the command we just heard. Go forward. Move ahead. And that is the following. Now, if you look at verse 21 and kind of parse it there, there's quite a while. There's a long period of time between the time Moshe first stretches out his hand over the sea and the time when it's ready for them to go through. And essentially the Midrash, the story, the claim, goes something like this. That at the point where it was time to go forward, the waters hadn't completely finished the process of receding. Not like what we saw in Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments, where it happens in about 5 seconds of cinema time. In fact, it probably took a little bit longer. And in fact, it would seem, and here comes the story part, the Midrash. Can't prove it, but again, it's interesting, that there were a couple of the leaders of Israel. And the Midrash actually names them. I don't think we need to, because the point is made anyway, and that's what resonates with me. That a couple of these leaders, basically, before the waters were completely split, went ahead and went forward, as commanded, moved on out. And it was this act of faith, of moving on out, that essentially marked the transition, if you will, the last period of time where the waters completely split, and then the rest, in fact, did go through upon dry ground. I like the metaphor there. I like the simile, the picture of people who know and have enough trust that what he said is going to happen is going to happen, that they move forward without necessarily waiting for all of the I's to be dotted and the T's to be crossed. From here we move on. So do the Egyptians. They pursue. They went after them. Obviously, a little while later, there was a little bit of a gap between them. All Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. It came to pass in the morning watch that Yahuwah looked forth upon the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of cloud, and he discomfited the host of the Mitraites, the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. You can picture them getting bogged down. The Egyptians said, whoa, let's get the heck out of here. Let us flee from the face of Israel, because it is Yahuwah that fights for them against us. And then Yahuwah finally says to Moshe, stretch out your hand over the sea. Let's bring those waters back together upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. So Moshe did as commanded. He stretched forth his hand. The sea returned to its strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it. And and Yahuwah overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned, covered the chariots, the horsemen, everything, the entire host of Pharaoh, and there remained not so much as one of them. But it tells us again, now here's the Atbash, the beginning and ending brackets. They started out, they went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, waters on the left, waters on the right, and it ends the same way, verse 29, as it was in verse 22. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. We've seen almost that same verse now as a bracket twice. Thus it says, Yahuwah saved. That's that root word we know, shu or shua. Israel, that day, out of the hand of the Egyptians, and furthermore, Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. It's a very graphic understanding. It's one thing to say, okay, I think we're free from bondage, and it's a whole another thing to see the taskmasters, literally the people that held them in bondage and did the dirty work, dead upon the seashore. And at that point, they have a visceral understanding of what has happened that they arguably didn't have before. And it says in verse 31, kind of making the point, and Israel saw the great work that Yahuwah had done upon the people of Mitzrayim, and the people Yareh, they feared, they respectfully feared Yahuwah, and further, they believed him, because now they've seen that what he had said he would do, he has done and is doing, and further, they believed in his servant Moshe. So there's not only an escape that has happened as promised, there's an overcoming that has happened as promised, and finally they see it. So the portion ends in chapter 15 with the song of Moshe. And he sang this song, saying, I will sing unto Yahuwah, for he is highly exalted. The horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Yahuwah is my strength and my song. He has become Le Yeshua. This is my El, and I will glorify him. My father's El, and I will exalt him. Yahuwah is a man of war. Not just a man of war. That's the literal word there. But as Rashi points out, it needs to be understood. He is a master of war. On the chess-playing scale, he is indeed the grand master. Yahuwah is his name. He cast Pharaoh's chariots and his host into the sea. Chosen captains are sunk. The depths cover them. Thy right hand, O Yahuwah, glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Yahuwah, dashes in pieces the enemy. In the greatness of your excellency, you overthrew them that rose up against you. You sent forth your wrath, consumed them as stubble. The blast of your nostrils piled up the waters. The flood stood upright as a heap, and the depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. Verse 9 here is kind of interesting. This is one of the places where we get almost a parallel, if you will, a satanic, an adversarial. Remember, ha-satan is the adversary. And Pharaoh, in this case, is playing the role of the adversary to Yah. Who is this Yahuwah, right? I know him not. The enemy says, just like we had the I wills that Yahuwah promised and delivered on, he says some things, taking the phrase, I will, and it turns out, no, you won't. I will pursue. Well, he did that. I will overtake. Not quite. I will divide the spoil. Wrong. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. Well, I guess you could say it came to an end, right? It was fulfilled. There you go. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. Wrong. You blew with your wind, it says. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Mikamocha, it says in the next line. Mikamocha Balim Yahuwah. We sang that song for the same reason. Who is like you, O Yahuwah, among the Elohim, the mighty ones? Who is like you, glorious in set apartness, holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? And that's the key. What we're seeing here, what we're memorializing and thinking about, is this act of deliverance. And indeed, one of the foremost, certainly most memorable, most famous, but on the scale of minimum necessary miracles, as I sometimes like to talk about, this one was a biggie. Minimum necessary miracle in this case, huge. Parting of the waters of the Red Sea and the overthrowing of the mightiest military force on the planet. In your love, you led the people that you've redeemed. You've guided them in your strength to your set-apart habitation. People heard, they tremble. Pangs have taken hold on the inhabitants of Philistia, up the coast there. Then were the chiefs of Edom affrighted, mighty men of Moab, all of them, basically, all the inhabitants of Canaan heard, they melted away. Terror and dread. Your people pass over, O Yahuwah, and your people will pass over that you have now gotten. Bring them in, plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place that you have made for you to dwell in, your sanctuary, O Yahuwah, which your hands have established, because Yahuwah shall reign forever and ever. And we get a reprise. The horses of Pharaoh went in with his chariots and with his horsemen into the sea. But the children of Israel, in fact, walked on dry land in the midst of the sea. And the story ends where Miriam the prophetess, and she is one of the few people that is called by that name. And it's the first time, I think, in the book that we see her called a prophetess. And I think it's the first time, as a matter of fact, yes, that we see her name being used in this context. Sister of Aaron, prophetess Miriam, took a timbrel. All the women went out with her with timbrels, and they sang and they danced. They literally witnessed. Sang the following, "Sing ye to Yahuwah, for he is highly exalted. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea." And then it says, Moshe led the people of Israel, Kol Israel, onward from the Sea of Reeds. They went out to the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. There comes this point where they come to Marah. The word means bitter. They couldn't drink the waters of Marah, for they in fact were Marah. They were bitter. Therefore the name of the place was called Marah, bitter. And they murmured, whining, "What are we going to drink?" Right? This is not so good. And Moshe cried to Yahuwah, who showed him a tree. He cast it into the waters, and they made the waters sweet. Therefore he made for them a statute and an ordinance, a hook, ve mishpat, and there he tested them. Now we talked about this before. We'll talk about it some other time. What was the statute and the ordinance? A lot of speculation there. One is a hook, right? That's the thing that you do because he says so. You don't have to understand it. And an ordinance. There are a number of possible candidates, right? The premier hook is called the red heifer. Okay, that might be what it is. There's going to be a different kind of a heifer that's going to appear and figure prominently pretty soon. Arguably, though, we're talking about Sabbath, because when he gets around to giving these folks the Sabbath a while later, as we know, he tells them, "You've already been told this." And here comes the final verses of the Parsha, and it's a great way to summarize and end the week of unleavened bread as we look ahead to that. He said, "If you will diligently shema, guard, hearken to the voice of Yahuwah Eloheka, and you will do that which is right in his eyes, and will give ear to his commandments," is mitzvotin, "and to keep all of his hukin, his statutes, then," he says, "I'll put none of the diseases upon you that you've already seen, which I put upon the Egyptians, for ani Yahuwah Rapha. I am Yahuwah the healer, the one who heals you." And let's end with that line. We could go one more verse, but that's actually where the portion ends, and it's a particularly appropriate one, because, again, so much of this seems to apply today. Ani Yahuwah Rapha. We live in a land that I will contend is grossly, vastly, horribly, almost beyond, but certainly very much in need of healing on so many fronts. And I will contend that there's only one possible way that it could happen, and that's with his healing, by his hand. And indeed, it's important that we remember in that case that he is Yahuwah Rapha.